We are starting a talk show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We start tonight's show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called The Spirit of St. Louis. Then music by the band Spirit, namely Nature's Way and Taurus. We'll also feature music by Maya from Japan from her album Lemonade. And for the main course, an interview with Lila Sage. You won't want to miss that. Stay tuned.
I was Plan B. I was the backup driver. I was the safety net. I was the second choice. My friend Mike recently acquired a 38-foot Georgetown XL RV. He got a great deal on the thing, but the catch was the RV was in St. Louis, and Mike lives in Los Angeles. Mike needed someone to help him drive this behemoth from St. Louis to Los Angeles. Mike has a recently retired friend that enthusiastically volunteered for the trip. Mike's friend was his first choice for the trip. He was Plan A. I agreed to be the backup driver in the event that something happened to Plan A. Sadly, Plan A had a health issue the week of the trip, so I was next up in driver rotation. I was on deck. I had been called up from the minor leagues. I was soon to be in the driver's seat. Hello, American Airlines? Yes, I'd like to buy a one-way ticket to St. Louis. A sentence I thought I would never utter. My friend Peter provided me with car service to LAX on Sunday, and he says to me, "You're a better man than me." I assume he was talking about my willingness to drive a 10-ton piece of metal across the United States in December with a friend that's had two automobile accidents in the last 3 months. I met my friend Mike at Lambert Field in St. Louis, and it's after our sumptuous accommodations for the evening, the airport sleep-in, MSNBC, Chinese food delivered, and an edible cookie for dessert, and the evening was soon nothing but a dream. Monday, December the 3rd, we're going to RV school. Gene, the owner of the RV, picks us up at the sleep-in at 9 a.m. Mike and I put our bags in the back of Gene's SUV. There was a In God We Trust and Joy FM decal on the back window of the SUV. Gene was a man of God. I felt comfortable around him. Gene drove us to the RV park on the outskirts of St. Louis, and there it was, Mike's new Georgetown XL RV, 38 feet of freshly washed and polished aluminum and glass. It was set up in the RV park with three bump outs, or slides as they're known in the RV trade, fully extended. This thing was big. It's at least three times as big as my first apartment. It had a complete kitchen setup with a bathroom with a shower and private toilet, a master bedroom with lots of closets, a living room with a fireplace, albeit electric. There were two large screen TVs, one in the bedroom and one in the living room. When you open the door to the RV, the steps descend from the slide. Nice. The coach naming ceremony was brief. Gene, Mike, and I stood in front of the coach, and Mike said, "I pronounce you the Spirit of St. Louis." Sadly, no champagne or swords were involved. According to Gene, you cannot get into a KOA RV Park without a name for your coach. Almost immediately, the name was abbreviated to just Spirit. This evoked memories of the band Spirit. Mike, with his head shaven, became Ed Cassidy. I was Randy California. Gene seemed somewhat befuddled with our singing, "It's Nature's Way of Telling You Something's Wrong." We had to explain it to him. I feel certain Gene thought he was dealing with members of a cult. My view was that at least we were not Thelma and Louise driving the coach off of a cliff. We placed our baggage in the RV and Gene started his tutorial on the RV. We spent several hours learning the control panel, the TV antenna, learning how to operate the televisions, the fireplace. There's a complete waterworks under the RV. A city water system, a tank water system, tanks for brown and black water. There's another locker under the RV for the electrical system with a long cable to connect to the grid. We learned about jacking systems under the RV that is used to level the beast. We finally got around to things you must do before moving the RV. There are steps up. Is the antenna down? Are the jacks up? Has the RV been disconnected from electricity and water? Gene patiently walked us through several disconnects and the dumping of black and gray water, and we were off for a test drive. Mike was first. No real problems other than his nerves, his, mine, and Gene's. Mike drove about 20 miles, turned around, then it was my turn. I drove back to the RV park, stopping to fuel this baby up along the way. Fortunately for Mike, gas in Missouri is cheap, $1.85 a gallon. With an 80-gallon tank, you can see that filling up is not for the faint of heart or those with bad credit. We had leftover Chinese food for dinner. Tuesday, December 4th. One thing Mike and I agreed on emphatically is that we would not drive in the snow. So imagine my surprise when I woke up at 5:30, steps outside the RV to disconnect and found the ground covered in white powder. I had things to do in Los Angeles, so I rationalized that the snow was not sticking to the road and I was driving the first shift. I-44, here we come, hell or high water, snow or not. The snow was not sticking to the freeway until we started up into some hills. At one point, I'm thinking, maybe we should have stayed in St. Louis and waited until the weather was getting warmer. The snow was about 4 inches thick on the freeway. Another 50 miles and we were out of the snow. Mike checked the forecast for the cities in front of us, all clear. The Spirit was powered by a big V10 motor. It was not fast off the line, but give her some straight, flat freeway, and this 22,500-pound beast would cruise down the freeway at 75 miles an hour. I wasn't paying for the gas, and I had stuff to do in Santa Monica, so I kept the cruise control locked at 75. People I have talked to about this trip asked me, quote, "What sort of mileage did you get?" End quote. If you have to ask, you can't afford it. How the heck did I know? I wasn't paying for the gas. The people of Missouri have a good sense of humor. There's a town on I-44 named Uranus, like the planet Uranus. There's a fudge shop in Uranus. There were 40 miles of billboards stating, "The best fudge comes from Uranus. The best fudge is in Uranus." There was also the jerky outlet. According to their billboards, nobody beats our meat. It is not enough that there was a store that sells only jerky, but there was an outlet for just jerky. Wednesday, December 5th. I drove the first shift. We crossed into the Texas Panhandle, and I noticed the Spirit of St. Louis was getting a little more difficult to handle. She wanted to move to the apron of the road. The Texas Panhandle seems to be devoid of vegetation other than thick grass growing for miles in all directions. I did notice there were a lot of windmills on the horizon. There's a reason why utility companies put windmills in certain places. It's normally windy there. I suggested that Mike take the wheel for a while, and he foolishly agreed. Mike fought the Spirit of St. Louis all the way across the Texas Panhandle. Thank God and the Federal Transportation Agency for putting rumble strips on the shoulder of the interstate highway system. At the end of 3 hours, Mike was exhausted and I took over again. Mike had driven a 38-foot-long, 13-foot-high aluminum sail on wheels across one of the windiest spots in America. Within 30 minutes of me taking the wheel, we were in New Mexico. The terrain changed and the wind died down and the windmills disappeared. Gene's prayers had been answered. We listened to a biography of Bobby Kennedy read by author Chris Matthews. It made the trip go a lot faster. As I'm driving into Albuquerque, Mike was checking the weather at our next stop, Flagstaff, Arizona. Snow. We made a decision to turn south on I-25 and drop down to intersect with I-10 in Las Cruces. The change in route added about 200 miles to our trip. We did not want to be in Flagstaff Mountains in the snow. Thursday, December 6th. Another early start, 6 a.m. The roadside inn breakfast room was basically a bowl of raisin bran, a cup of coffee, and off to the spirit, who cheerfully started right up. Have I mentioned how beautiful New Mexico is? They don't call it the land of enchantment for nothing. Driving through it was like being on every Western movie you ever saw. Absolutely lovely. It had been raining in the desert, and the effect was profound. The desert had erupted in bloom, particularly on the shoulders of I-10. It was as if the desert was saying, "Calm down, summer is coming." The shoulders of the road were saying, "Let's party." Yellow flowers lined the freeway for mile after mile. The ocotillo, saguaro cactus, paddle cactus, creosote bush, and the mesquite were all in great form. The desert felt clean. We left New Mexico and headed into Arizona. Mike wanted to drive through Tucson. He had lived there for 12 years. We stopped to fuel up on the Phoenix Bypass. I drove for a while. Then Mike wanted to drive through Palm Springs. It started to rain. Not good for Mike. Then it got dark. Really not good for Mike. Finally, Mike looked at me and announced that he could not take it anymore and pulled off at the next exit. It was dark and raining. It was like that scene in the movie Network where Howard Beale was exhorting his fans to yell out their windows, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore." Mike had the look of a lunatic in his eyes. Clearly, it was time for me to slide into the driver's seat or risk Mike having a stroke, a heart attack, or being arrested. He was about an eighth of an inch from going postal. Mike then decided we should stay at the casino for an evening and gamble. My feeling was I was driving a 38-foot aluminum sail down the freeway at 75 miles an hour. That was enough of a gamble for me. But it was Mike's trip, and I was only the driver, and I was the second choice at that. Mike went to check on a room at the Morongo Casino. The only room available was a $250 suite, so the spirit was back on the road for a few more miles. I felt like I had dodged a bullet. Like I said, I'm not a gambler. Back on the interstate, we were only 90 miles from Los Angeles. I could almost feel myself sleeping in my own bed that night. But no, it was not meant to be. Michael wanted to stay in Banning at another fine sleeping establishment, Motel 6. Mike's logic was that his arrival date at the RV park in Los Angeles was Friday. He did not want to show up early. Precision, I got it. Friday, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. 90 miles to go. Another less than stellar roadside motel breakfast, cellophane wrapped muffins, plain bagels, Yoplait yogurt, and my favorite, raisin bran. Mike asked if I would drive the last leg. Sure, it's only 90 miles. That 90 miles took 5 hours. We were in morning traffic the entire way. That was the longest 90 miles I've ever driven. We rolled into the Hollywood RV park a little after 11 a.m. I backed the Spirit into a temporary parking slot, put my bags in Mike's VW, and was home by 12:30 p.m. We had driven almost 2,000 miles in 3.5 days. Conclusion: it was a great trip, a learning experience, and I would do it again tomorrow. Thanks, Mike. Nature's waiting.
It is July 21st, 2021. I have Lila Sage in studio today, who is a certified hypnotherapist who specializes in intimacy authenticity. Hi, Lila Sage.
Hi there, Pete. Thank you for having me.
So you help people work through some of these internal issues.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about it.
At the core, it's helping people align their subconscious beliefs with their conscious desires so that they can create the type of life that they're wanting.
So people might come to you and say, I can't find my soulmate, I don't have a happy relationship, and you explore some of the issues that's interfering.
Right, yeah. Whatever's happening internally for them to look at, evaluate. What I notice the most of is people having non-traditional desires that they're afraid to express to a partner. And then holding that internally causes a lot of stress for them. So when they're working with me, it's coming to a place of acceptance about what they're wanting so they can show up authentically with a partner and be able to express those desires.
And I think you're telling me that everyone isn't built exactly the same and we're not just generic, off-the-shelf toilet paper kind of products, that we each have very specific individual interests and desires. Is that what you're saying?
Very much so. Very much so.
Do you find people like want to get into some like really bizarre things or kinky things? Or?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes it can be really gentle, but they've built up a fear. So like a common interest may be something like feet. Like one partner is really interested in feet, giving foot massages, things of that nature. But they've been shut down and shunned by past partners. So now that's something that they internalize and don't want to express.
So sometimes people have fetishes.
Yeah.
I mean, how common is this?
I'd say very common. I think that everyone has some kind of kink, some kind of curiosity that they're interested in exploring.
Explain about hypnotherapy.
Hypnotherapy is a tool that we use for self-mastery, one of many tools that people can use. And for this specific process, you're usually working with a hypnotherapist, someone who's going to guide you, and it's a very passive experience. So generally, the person receiving is seated or lying down. They get into a very relaxed state. And then once they are in that relaxed state and receptive, the hypnotherapist will give suggestions that the client is wanting in how they can change and improve their lives. And exactly what direction they're going in is generally discussed beforehand in like a cognitive face-to-face conversation about the new patterns that that client would like to create and what they'd like to see in their conscious outer awake life.
Sounds like a rather creative process and very individualistic.
Very much so. I've noticed that people can have similar presenting problems, so whether that's around smoking cessation or weight loss or motivation, you know, these are things that are fairly common, may come up in people's lives. But where it becomes more individual is the symbol that it holds for the person and what kind of words are going to impact them. So if you say you're going to be more motivated and they don't feel a connection to the word motivation, it's not going to land, it's not going to change.
Hmm.
But if their drive centers around focus and you use the word focus, you're bringing an emotional charge to that word, and then that will have that personal stronger effect for them.
Sounds like it's very much about unlocking who a person is. You can't just say to somebody, run a 4-minute mile, and they're just going to run a 4-minute mile like they're a robot. You have to somehow engage with their deeper thoughts and emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I say that it's like a 50-50 work. So when you're working with a hypnotherapist, they'll be able to give these subconscious suggestions to give you the new pattern, the new program that you can operate off of. But it's going to take a little bit of work on your side to actually integrate it into your life. So if you say, and it wouldn't be as blunt and direct as this, but you know, you're going to stop smoking. We're going to cut your usage down to 1 pack a week. Say they're a really heavy smoker. It's going to be up to them when they're not in the chair, when they're not in the session, to actually cut that down. Now they have a new pattern. It's going to be a little easier for them. We're also teaching coping strategies and skills that they can use for when those little cravings may come back. But now they have a new default that they're working off of.
This is good information because I guess for some reason I was under this impression, probably some of the listening audience too, that there was some kind of mechanism about this. It's just like when you get hypnotherapy, you just pull a lever and then the person just operates in a new way. But it doesn't sound like it happens like that at all. You could just say, stop smoking, and that will have no effect unless you kind of figure out what's underneath it, explore those issues. They have to work on it. In other words, it's a process. They're not just a machine where you can turn an on and off switch and make a big change.
Sometimes it does happen like that.
Oh, sometimes it does.
Sometimes it does.
You say, stop smoking, boom.
If the person is really, really primed for that change and it's something really dramatic in their life, say, you know, they have a major health issue, something that's really creating that motivation for them, having the right permission, having the right words that connect for them. But yeah, it can be. If they're really primed for it and really wanting to make a change and they just need to hear that one thing that's going to kick them into high drive, sometimes it will work like that. And I've seen it happen like that.
You talk to somebody and then there's some kind of relaxation process. Please explain.
Generally, I will lead people through kind of like a guided meditation. We'll do a body scan where they can focus on different parts of their body and consciously relax them, maybe tighten muscles and then release. And that'll allow the body to be a bit more passive, not tense, because when we're tense, we're not in a learning environment. In hypnosis, you want to be in a learning environment, so you're getting very relaxed. So we relax the body, we relax the mind, and then you're kind of creating a corridor down into the subconscious mind, and that's where they can receive new information.
And so when they're in this subconscious mind, tell me if I'm getting it correctly, that they're just in a very relaxed, receptive state. That's a very creative place with a lot of options, instead of this worrying state, which kind of nothing can come in and go out of. They're getting so fluid and supple that changes can happen. It's not like turning them into a robot or something like that.
Oh, not at all.
That performs tasks.
Yeah, no, we're opening up the possibilities. So when you do a task, when you're doing anything, even a thought pattern over and over, you're creating like a neural pathway, a groove.
Okay.
And that gets strengthened. You get more myelin sheath around it. You're like building it stronger and stronger. So if that's a thing you don't want, like smoking or being tardy or whatever it is, you have to break that connection, create a new connection, and strengthen that.
So I have a friend who's having an obsession problem. The boyfriend dumped her, and she's thinking about him constantly. She's thinking about him four times a second kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And when you talk to her, the conversation will keep coming back to this breakup 4 months ago. Like, she'll bring him up several times a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go with something like that?
Yeah. In that case, I'd say it's almost like a drug. Like, your body has gotten used to that fix or that person.
Okay.
And if they're really important to you, and that's your default pattern or your go-to, yeah, that can be really challenging to break. Whenever I've worked with people in the past who have gone through something similar, I'll use a process called de-loving, and that basically empowers them to take charge of their own emotion, kind of release the emotional sting around the relationship. Yeah, take back whatever they've given. So they're kind of reimagining and envisioning this new version of themselves that they can then step into. Does that make sense? A little esoteric.
I think what you're saying is true, that love can be an addiction. Losing a love, it has very similar symptoms of heroin withdrawal.
Yeah, it creates a very physical response in the body.
You
have dopamine that's released and oxytocin, and
you may vomit, you may be unable to slake, the same things people go through when they're trying to get off a hard drug.
Yeah, you have so much emotion that it's happening physically.
So the hypnotherapist, say you're helping someone get off an addiction, but maybe a chemical addiction now.
Right. For chemical addictions, it's a little different. I haven't done a ton of work with any like hard drugs, so that's difficult for me to speak to. What I can speak to is cigarettes.
Or cigarette addiction, which is supposed to be one of the hardest addictions to deal with.
Which is interesting, because usually it's less of the chemicals. So unless you're smoking like over 10 cigarettes a day, you won't have a physical chemical addiction. It's usually an addiction to glucose, which is found in the cigarettes.
Ooh.
So it's
sneaky
blood sugar regulation that you work with on the physical level. And then it's understanding the triggers that cause people to get cigarettes. Is it that you need a 5-minute break from work because you're stressed out or stressed from your family and you need to give that relaxation to yourself? We also teach breathing techniques, because what are you doing when you're inhaling? You might just need a deep breath and to let your nervous system reset. So a lot of these things, we think we're addicted to the thing. It's not the thing. It's the association with, ooh, I get 10 minutes if I'm a smoker and I get to go outside, or I get 5 minutes away from my partner who's arguing with me, or I just need a reset. So now we're creating new patterns around, okay, is it acceptable for you to say, I need 10 minutes at work and go outside without needing the cigarette? Chances are, yes, your boss is going to be okay with that. But yeah, it's working with that repat. The cigarettes oftentimes, and not always, because some people do have that chemical dependence if they're smoking several packs a day or whatnot. But a lot of times just creating that new association. I feel stressed. What do I want to do when I feel stressed? Do I want to smoke? No, I want something else. Okay, what are the solutions? What are the options that we want to do differently that's going to provide that same relief?
I see. So it's a bundle of needs and impulses. And particularly with smoking, you pull it apart. Is it a breath? Or, I mean, a lot of teenagers start smoking because it's a way to socialize. You get to hang out with the whatever the cool kids if you smoke. So it's giving you a social opportunity. Not that you really wanted to smoke or anything, but now you're a smoker and it helps you socialize with other smokers.
Right. It becomes part of the identity, basically. Like, I am a smoker. This is not me personally, but in their mind, this is what I do. This is part of my social experience. So yeah, sometimes it can be, okay, we're going to have to maybe find some new friends who don't smoke. That could be part of it as well.
So you slow things down, identify the different pieces. There's some things they have to do on their own. There's alternatives that have to be provided. And then there's the hypnotherapy session.
Yeah, it can take the emotional edge off of things. It can make it feel less immediate. So if for anyone who's ever had like a craving, whether that's for a cigarette or for a cookie at midnight, you'll feel this impulse of like, if I don't do this right now, I will die.
Yeah.
It's very strong. So the hypnotherapy process can calm that impulse. So it's less intense, less strong, and then a little bit easier to catch in the moment and manage so that you can make effective decisions towards what you actually want, as opposed to just chasing that dopamine or that easy fix that you're looking for.
The I probably shouldn't get into this, but like the one addiction I struggle with is, so I'm really good at like not eating. I can go hours and hours without eating, but when I eat dinner, I want to graze the entire evening after that. I just want to keep eating for hours until I go to sleep. I don't know what's going on, if it's loneliness or, you know, I'm going through all my cupboards. Okay, I'm past the third dessert now, and now I'm into the salty foods. Okay, salty food's done. We'll have some liquor now. Like, I have various chapters of my evening eating experience.
Yeah, I have a few different guesses or thoughts, rather. So it could be...
Now, you're my therapist. Okay.
It's kind of fun. We're dissecting. If you aren't eating as much during the day, it could be blood sugar. So now you're getting to the end of the night and your body is saying, we need calories. We haven't had enough today. So you're immediately going to go for the sweet, the salty, whatever's going to give you that high calorie, okay, now we feel sated feeling.
So wait a second. So what you're saying is, maybe I'm hungry.
Yes, it could be.
Maybe I'm hungry. Okay, good.
It could be hunger.
A pretty good, obvious place to start.
That's often what I'll recommend for people as a first for anything, just looking at the diet. Are you eating every couple of hours? Because otherwise, you know, a lot of people get like the 3 p.m. like slump in their day. yeah, that it's just enough time after lunch where that food has worn off and it's not quite dinner time yet. Maybe you just need a snack. And sometimes it's as easy as that.
Right.
It could also be if you're used to, okay, every time I'm editing, I'm going to have this cookie. That's my reward, or that's, you know, what helps me get in the mood or whatever. You've created that association with that food and that task.
This whole like mid-afternoon wanting to eat thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people are actually tired. Like they really want to take a nap. And if they just take like a siesta mid-afternoon, they don't really need to eat, but that's like the substitute that's socially acceptable.
Oh, definitely.
Go to sleep.
Naps are great. 20-minute power nap, reset your nervous system, you feel refreshed.
I'm a napper.
Naps are wonderful.
I'm ashamed to admit it. No, I think some famous people have been nappers.
Yeah, naps are wonderful.
Oh, good.
If it allows you to perform at your best, I'm all for it.
I'm glad. Okay, I got permission. Good.
Not that you needed it.
You're trying to interrupt some of the patterns that people are having in their life. And I know one of the biggest patterns is one of gender. Mm-hmm. We identify with how we're born or, you know, the girls' locker room or the boys' locker room we go into. And that's who we are. And that we put on those clothes and those identities. Well, and I'm thinking of a party I went to as a young man. It was a cross-dressing party. And we were all asked to come as something we were not used to being. And I dressed up as a woman and quite beautiful, I must say.
A nice
tight dress. Mm-hmm. The neat thing about the party, it wasn't particularly that sexual. It was playful. And everybody was friendly, and we were having so much fun. I think it was the most fun I ever had at a party because we all got outside of ourselves. This main identifying factor was suddenly interrupted. It was just a wonderful experience of opening my mind. I put the women's clothes back in the closet, and I haven't taken them out since because I kind of liked it too much. Let's just pack that one away. Any thoughts about gender identity and breaking the pattern on that level?
Yeah, it's fun that you went to a party where you got to be someone completely different. That's so fun. I think that's part of the joy of costuming, which essentially with gender, you're costuming, right?
Yes.
Wearing, you know, a dress or the pantsuit or what have you. And to consciously choose to put on a different costume, you get to really play with what does it mean to be a woman or a man? What does it mean to feel just embodied in a different way? And you get to play with that, get to play with those roles. I say go out and buy the wig. Go try on different colors. Anything that gets you out of your normal, I feel like we're talking more about styling, but anything that gets you out of your normal day-to-day of how you perceive yourself, how you look in the mirror. Oh, I always wear glasses. I always wear this color of blue. And it gets you to try new things, to be more playful, to get your brain to think in a different way because you're working with that pattern interrupt and trying different things.
And you put on entertainment events that help people flow in this area.
I do. I create immersive experiences for people, specifically for the kink curious who are interested in trying out new explorations, things that they may be interested in that are non-traditional desires. And that could be anything like cross-dressing, playing with sensation play, with dom and sub dynamics.
What is a response?
Fun, playful. People are really enjoying it. It's nice to not be you for a bit, right? To try on a different character or a different role, to dress up differently, just to create space for that exploration. If you're always the instigator, is not quite the right word, but instigator in a relationship, if you're the person who's planning dates and moving forward and things, and you want to try being more on the receptive side, that may be very uncomfortable or very different for you. But in working with those new ideas, new patterns, you can find out a lot about yourself.
It seems to me that power dynamics, power interactions underlie most of society. In other words, power and who's choosing and who's in control is just a constant factor.
Mm-hmm.
And the BDSM community says, well, look, this is a fact and a fact about our sexuality, so let's own it. Let's do it. Let's play this out instead of pretending it's everything is sweet and equal and we all want the same thing. No, we sometimes want very different things, sometimes opposite things. So let's do it. And there seems to be a certain freedom there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, within the kink community, the BDSM community, we take those subconscious power dynamics and make them very conscious, make them something that you can play with. And like you said, if you have those oppositional desires, there's a place for it. What I think is also really unique is that before there's any type of play and interaction when you're going to create and heighten generally those power dynamics, you're meeting at the table as equals and then choosing to consciously move into those power dynamics.
So consent is at the front door.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. And there's ways for people to back out of situations that they don't want to be in or they get overwhelmed?
Yes, always.
Like some safe word or so?
Yeah, you could have a safe word. If you're doing a type of play that's nonverbal, people will like hold on to keys and then drop them if they need to stop. There are a bunch of different ways to signal to your partner that you need to change or do something differently.
So you don't get in a situation where you are not happy and have no voice where you can express discontent.
Right. Oh, of course. Yeah, we don't want that. It should be playful. It should be fun. Kink and exploration should be fun.
So I'm talking with Lila Sage, and you can find her at MissLilaSage.com. And we're talking about pattern interruption, how to become less robotic, less binary as people, more alive, more fluid, more options, more choices, both with more traditional therapeutic issues, addiction and so forth, but also romantically and sensually. And let's talk about spirituality now. And you're a spiritual facilitator and open realms to people so they can feel more presence there and more options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another level to work on with clients. For me as a facilitator will look like creating a ritual for a client. So for instance, one client came to me and said that they were experiencing a lot of internal verbal abuse. They were calling themselves names. You know, anytime they did something they perceived as messing up, oh, you're stupid or worthless, or all of these thoughts that were just kind of on loop. And we identified that they had come from past parental figures and teachers and different people in his life, and he had internalized that, and now that was his default. So what he came to me for was to externalize that so he could hear instead of just having it be the default. So what we decided to do within that session, we wrote out all of the different names and words that he was calling himself, and then I took on that role of being the voice. So we would get him into a relaxed state, doing some meditation, some grounding work, so that he felt really present. And then I began reading off the list, speaking those different things to put him in that space where he could really hear, oh, this is what I'm doing to myself. And to really be conscious, because now someone else was speaking it to him. And in that space, that opened up for him, do I really want to continue to do this? Do I want to beat myself up every time I perceive a shortcoming? And the option that we opened up instead was one of self-compassion and acceptance. Okay, instead of calling yourself stupid, what can we say? You know, what would you say to a child? Can often be a nice entry point, gateway into that. You know, it's okay, you'll do better next time. Or you're learning. It can be something as simple and gentle as that. And, you know, we all kind of beat up on ourselves at times. It's nice to know that there are other options. And when you have that externalized and you can see someone else standing in for you, it's a little easier to notice, to create those new paths, and then start living like that.
Mm. You're opening up spiritual space for people, place for their spirit to unwind and settle down and relax on this planet. You seem like an extraordinarily sensitive person yourself, like this antenna picking up all this energy from the world. I'm sure we both struggle with how to feel comfortable in a kind of a rough and tumble reality, both being sensitive to subtle vibrations. And I think a lot of listeners to this show are in that same place. Any words about people feeling safe, feeling comforted, sacred space? How do sensitives and artists and visionaries live in this world so they're not overwhelmed and they can do their work and really be effective?
Yeah, I think it's really important to give yourself that space and whatever that looks like for you. And it's very individual. So that can be spending time by yourself, going into nature. I will get into that flow space when I'm blending teas or journaling or taking a really long walk just around my neighborhood. Anything that you can do that will lessen that weight on your spirit, kind of whatever burden you're feeling, will help you get into that creative space.
Mm.
Yeah.
Safe, sacred space. Lila Sage, thank you for your time. People can find you at MissLilaSage.com. You have a whole cornucopia of talents and a lot of ways you can help people in a lot of different directions. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oh, 静かな水辺に渡り鳥が息を加えてこの地に来た。いくつも枝と土を集めて大きな船を作り始めた。
We are coming to the end of a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started the show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called The Spirit of St. Louis. Then two tunes by the band called Spirit, Nature's Way, and Taurus. Then we heard a tune by Maya from Japan called Lemonade. Then an extended interview with Lila Sage. And wrapped it up with more tunes by Maya, Red Bicycle, Quiet Boat, and a little bit of Lemonade, the English version. To find her music, search the album Lemonade by Mayako Ino. Thanks so much for listening. Mystic Pete out!